This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Well, here at Politics and Prose, we are no stranger to the art of the political biography. And today we are delighted to witness a two-time best-selling biographer take us on a thrilling dive into the escapades of a young Churchill, whose big personality is only heightened by Millard's guidance into an episode of the Lion's Life in South Africa and the Boer War. Millard's unique factual storytelling recounts a little-known episode in the life of a legendary world leader, and recounts not only a riveting adventure with sharp and evocative details, but shows how the brush with danger and mortality crystallized a particular vision, one with consequences for the entire world. And the Guardian review of this book claims that Millard's Hero of the Empire is a fluent and readable account of Churchill's early life as a buccaneering, attention-seeking journalist and soldier. USA Today review praises, "Millard masters all the details, the letters home, the historical coincidences. This tome is a slam-bang study of Churchill's wit and wile as he navigates the Boer War like some proto-James Bond." Yeah. Candace Millard is a former writer and editor for National Geographic magazine. Her first book, The River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey, was a New York Times bestseller. Millard's second book, Destiny of the Republic, Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President, rose to number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list. Millard's work has also appeared in Time Magazine, Washington Post Book World, and New York Times Book Review. If you will, please join me in welcoming Candace Millard.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction, and thank all of you for coming tonight. It's such an honor for me to be here. You know, I lived in Washington, D.C. for 6 years, and believe me, I was at Politics and Prose all the time. So it's very exciting for me to be back. When most of us think of Winston Churchill, we think of an older man who was sort of round, had a cigar clamped in his teeth and holding on to a glass of whiskey and sending younger men into war. He is virtually a synonym for great leadership. He is a master politician, a savior of his country during World War II, winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, and one of the most famous human beings in history. But the problem with trying to understand a leader at the height of his career is that we often end up talking about the results of that person's character, and not the forces that created it. What I am trying to understand is where that man came from, what gave him the courage, the insight, and the will to become such a towering figure. So tonight, I'm going to talk about a very young man. He's only 24 years old. He's just left the military, the only job he's ever had, the only job for which he's been trained. He has no money. He's already tried to run for office and lost. He is like so many other children of privilege then and now who amount to nothing. So how do we connect this young man with the legend he later became? What made the Winston Churchill that we know? How did he become one of the most powerful and effective leaders that history has ever produced? I believe that an important part of the answer lies in an exceptional series of events which I describe in this book. It is a story of what happened when young Winston Churchill went to South Africa during the Boer War in 1899. Churchill didn't plan this story, and he couldn't have predicted it, but in every sense, he prepared for it, he understood its significance, he seized control of it, he risked everything to succeed in it, and he turned that opportunity into a life-changing moment that was directly responsible for his later path to power. There is a saying that luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity, and that is exactly what happened here. Churchill was only in Africa for a matter of months, but what happened there put the spark to the combustible mixture of intelligence, ambition, courage, and resourcefulness that defined him from his earliest years. It transformed this young man into a world-famous hero, setting him firmly on the path to greatness. And in doing so, it also transformed the world we live in. Before I talk about the Boer War and the action that takes place in this book, I would like to introduce you to young Churchill. He comes from a famous family. He's a direct descendant of the first Duke of Marlborough, John Churchill, who is considered to be one of the greatest generals in British history. His father, Lord Randolph Churchill, the third son of the seventh Duke, was the Chancellor of the Exchequer and leader of the House of Commons. And he was born at Blenheim Palace, the incredible estate that Queen Anne gave to John Churchill after the Battle of Blenheim in 1704. And if you've never seen it, I mean, it's just absolutely enormous. It sits, the estate itself, the palace itself, sits on 7 acres of a 2,000-acre private park. Churchill, however, never inherited either the title or the palace. He had no income, and his father, who had died a very public and tragic death when Churchill was only 20 years old, had left him very little money, most of which his mother had already spent. The good news was that he was naturally brilliant. He was also an exceptional writer, and he knew it. In fact, at 24, he had already written 3 books, including his first and only novel, Savrola. And he quickly discovered that he could make a living as a journalist, covering every war he encountered. But being a journalist was never going to be enough for Winston Churchill. He was fascinated with power and consumed by dreams of glory. He had trained to be a soldier, and he loved war. In fact, again, even though he's only 24 years old, he had already been involved in 3 different wars on 3 different continents. And he was willing to take any risk to be noticed. He had nearly been killed many times. Once the horse that had been standing right next to him was shot. Another time, a bullet severed the jaunty feather that was in his hat. He had killed men himself, once coming so close to his victim that his pistol struck the man as Churchill galloped by. And he had seen his friends not just killed, but mutilated, sliced to ribbons by their enemies. Even with all he had experienced, Churchill continued to seek out the most brutal battles the British Empire had to offer. He was the first to sign up and the first to show off however he could. He even, to the astonishment and horror of the men around him, rode a white pony on the battlefields in British India, just in the hope of being noticed. He said, "Given an audience, there is no act too daring or too noble. Without the gallery, things are different." Churchill was impatient to succeed and excel, to make his mark on the world, but no matter what he did, he couldn't get a foothold. The military was too slow for him, so he quit. He ran for his first seat in Parliament in the summer of 1899, but was rejected by voters. So frustrated and burning with ambition, he feverishly looked for his next opportunity, knowing that it was his destiny to lead. As he told his mother, he had faith in his star. Just 4 months later, war broke out in southern Africa. To the British, this was just another colonial war, one that they expected to be over in a matter of months, certainly by Christmas. Unfortunately, they had forgotten who they were fighting. The Boers had been living in South Africa for centuries, and in that time they had transformed from rogue splinter groups of largely Dutch, Huguenot, and German immigrants into an entirely new ethnic group, neither European nor African, but Boer. They had even developed their own language, Afrikaans, which mixes Dutch with everything from French and Portuguese to Khoikhoi. They were highly religious, unabashedly racist, and stubbornly independent. And most of all, they just wanted to be left alone. In an attempt to get away from the British Empire in 1835, just 2 years after the British Empire had abolished slavery, they had moved hundreds of miles from the Cape into the African interior in what would become known as the Great Trek, establishing three colonies of their own. Their independence, however, had lasted only as long as their poverty. In the mid-1800s, diamonds and then gold were discovered in the Transvaal, one of the Boer republics, transforming the region from one of the poorest in the world to one of the wealthiest. Paul Kruger, who would become president of the Transvaal, predicted that this gold will cause our country to be soaked in blood, and he was right. By 1877, Britain had annexed the Transvaal, a move that quickly led to the First Boer War in 1880. Nearly 20 years later, in the fall of 1899, little had changed. The British still wanted the Boers' land, and the Boers still insisted on their independence. The British Empire began amassing troops at the Transvaal borders, and the atmosphere, Churchill wrote, gradually but steadily became tense, charged with electricity, laden with the presage of storm. Finally, the Boers issued an ultimatum: stand down or prepare for war. The British, thrilled to have an excuse to go to war, allowed the deadline for the ultimatum to pass with little more than a sneer. Just 3 days after the war began, Winston Churchill, seeing his opportunity, was on a ship to South Africa, hired to cover the war as a correspondent. Churchill had never really followed the rules. His mother, the beautiful American socialite Jenny Jerome, had used her influence time and again to help her son win military appointments. "This is a pushing age," he had explained to her, "and we must push with the best." Since leaving Sandhurst, the Royal Military Academy, he had used every connection she had and every skill he had to promote himself. Now he was the highest paid correspondent England had ever had, and he was eager for the adventure that lay ahead. In South Africa, however, the situation had quickly begun to deteriorate. The British had seriously underestimated the Boers. Not only were they extraordinary marksmen with better weapons than the British, but they knew every nook and cranny of the South African veldt and could disappear without a trace, making them an invisible and very dangerous enemy. The British, in stark contrast, had only recently and very reluctantly begun dragging their military into the modern world. Sir Redvers Buller, Commander-in-Chief of Her Majesty's Army in South Africa, had been nicknamed the Steamroller because the British believed that he would make quick work of the Boers. His men, however, had only recently traded in their dashing red coats for khakis, which they bitterly complained made them look like bus drivers. And they continued to fight in perfect, precise lines, spreading themselves across the flat South African veldt like a picture in a storybook served up for slaughter. By the time Churchill reached South Africa, the British Army had already been humiliated by the Boers, losing the first battles and leaving the British stunned and scrambling to adjust to this new kind of warfare. As soon as Churchill arrived, with his valet, of course, as well as a nice selection of wine, a light port, a French vermouth, and 18 bottles of 10-year-old Scotch whiskey. He went as far and as fast as he could toward the front, which was now Ladysmith, a garrison town in the northeast, which was just south of Pretoria. By the time he arrived, however, the Boers had already completely cut off Ladysmith. No one could get in or out. "I was too late," Churchill dismally wrote. "The door was shut." So he was forced to make camp just 40 miles south of Ladysmith in a little town called Escort. 9 days later, as a heavy rain fell on the morning of November 15th, Churchill boarded the British Army's armored train. His old friend from his military days, Ulmer Haldon, had been ordered to take the train out in reconnaissance. Both men knew that it was a foolish, potentially disastrous decision. Not only was the train an easy target on the best of days, but the Boers had been spotted just outside of Escort only the day before. Haldon had no choice but to go. Churchill, on the other hand, did. But frustrated, restless, and he would later admit, eager for trouble, he did not hesitate for a moment when Haldon invited him to go along. Before the sun came up that morning, Churchill climbed into the first train car, an open trunk from which he would have the best vantage. Behind him, stretching down the tracks, were another armored car filled with men in their khaki uniforms and peaked helmets, the engine with its wide-mouthed black funnel and narrow tender, two more armored cars, and finally an ordinary low-sided truck that held tools and a few plate layers. As the train cut across the veldt, the Boers were silently and invisibly watching. Led by a respected and daring young general named Louis Botha, who would later become the first Prime Minister of South Africa. Botha knew not only where the train was going, he knew it would have to come back on the same tracks. As soon as the train passed them, he ordered his men to move to the bottom of a hill and began piling rocks on the tracks. When the train, on its way back to Escort, appeared at the top of the hill, the Boers opened fire, chasing it down the steep slope until it crashed into the stones, catapulting the first two cars off the tracks, killing several men, wounding others, and trapping them all in a hailstone of shells and bullets. Although he was only a journalist, one of the few civilians on the train, and again 24 years old, Winston Churchill immediately took charge of the defense, shouting orders as he ran back and forth from the engine to the last truck, organizing the men in a desperate attempt to free the train. In the end, he succeeded, and every man who made it out alive credited Churchill's resourcefulness and bravery for saving his life. Unfortunately, Churchill wasn't there to accept their gratitude or hear their praise. He had been captured and was taken as a prisoner of war to Pretoria. For Churchill, captivity was unbearable. He would never forget how it felt. Many years later, he wrote, "You feel a sense of constant humiliation in being confined to a narrow space, fenced in by railings and wire, watched by armed men. I certainly hated every minute of my captivity more than I have ever hated any period in my whole life." From the moment he became a prisoner, Churchill resolved to escape. Finally, with two other men, he had a plan. A 6.5-foot tall iron paling surrounded their prison, the Staatsmodel School, which was constantly patrolled by armed guards. When the electric lights came on at night, however, one corner of the yard remained dark. If one of the guards turned his back at just the right moment, they could make their move. After much discussion and careful planning, they chose their night. But when the time came, Churchill's co-conspirators found themselves trapped inside in the glare of the lights and the eyes of the guards. Churchill, who had already scaled the fence, suddenly realized that he was alone, facing the prospect of crossing almost 300 miles of enemy territory with no map, no compass, no food, no weapon, no ability to speak the language, and with the Boers, who were humiliated and enraged in hot pursuit. What Churchill did have was an absolute faith in his destiny and a clear-eyed understanding that this was a chance he had been waiting for. The story of Churchill's escape is an epic adventure by any standard. I won't tell you how he survived it. You'll have to read the book. But I will say that by the time it was over, Churchill was not only a free man, he rode back to Pretoria as part of a British regiment. He took over the prison, released the men who had been his former fellow prisoners, captured the jailers, and watched as the Boer flag was torn down and the Union Jack hoisted in its place. But more important than the story itself is what it meant to Churchill as a person, as a leader, and as an architect in the world we now live in. After he returned home from South Africa, he was what he had always dreamed of being, a hero of the empire. A famous man now, Churchill ran for Parliament again, and this time he won. His life and British politics would never be the same. If Churchill had previously dreamed about the power of his will and his destiny, now he had proof. He was unstoppable. He had not only been part of a great adventure, but he had done it alone. He would approach life and politics with an unshakable faith in his own abilities that would not only define his leadership, but provide a foundation of courage and confidence that would inspire entire nations. Churchill would also carry the humbling lessons of this experience throughout his life. He understood better than almost any other major leader the enormous cost and tragedy of war. He was also extremely compassionate about the plight of prisoners and determined to reach out the hand of friendship to those who had so lately been his enemies. As high as Churchill rose in the political stratosphere, he would never forget his capture, his imprisonment, or his escape from the Boers. As he himself would write, "This misfortune, could I have foreseen the future, was to lay the foundations for my later life." Those foundations, in turn, would help to support and shape much of the world we know today. Of course, Churchill didn't know that at the time, but I don't think it would have come as a surprise. Thank you. Thank you, and I'm happy to take questions if there are any.
It's often said that this Second Boer War served as sort of a rehearsal or an education for the British Army leading up to World War I. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about that some, please?
That's absolutely true, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to tell the story. The Boer War is really the beginning of modern warfare. So absolutely, the British Army that went into the Boer War was completely different from the British Army that came out of it, and it did prepare them for World War I. As I said, so they were still fighting in these perfect, precise lines, and the Boers were absolutely invisible, and they didn't know what to do with that, and so they were losing battle after battle after battle. And it was really interesting in particular to read the newspaper accounts of there's a journalist named George Warrington Stevens who any newspaper accounts I read, I always thought, you know, they don't come close to Winston Churchill's, actually, because Winston Churchill was such an incredible writer, except for George Warrington Stevens. His were almost poetry. They were fascinating. But he was trapped in Ladysmith while it was under siege, and he ended up actually dying there of typhoid. But he said, you know, it's really interesting. I think this is going to change us because slowly we're beginning to learn from the Boers. So they learned these guerrilla tactics. Unfortunately, it devolved because, again, they thought this is going to be a couple of months and we'll be out. And it ended up lasting almost 3 years. And at the end, just out of desperation, they started, you know, they had scorched earth policies. They had some of the first concentration camps. So they really you know, fell to new levels as well as changing at the same time. Yeah.
Oh,
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for bringing back that riveting story. But as you know, there was some criticism about that incident. One thing was that he joined the plan. He was invited to join the plan. Mm-hmm. He didn't create it. And he jumped. This is the criticism. I'm mm-hmm. saying it's true.
Sure.
But
yeah.
he jumped the gun.
Right.
And he left the other two, I believe,
uh-huh.
In lurch.
Right.
And they felt betrayed, mm-hmm. Et cetera. Now, mm-hmm. I'd like you to comment on that. I'm sure you're aware
right.
of all this.
Right. Yes, absolutely. So,
of course you are.
So, as I said, so Churchill was determined to escape from the moment he got there. But being Winston Churchill, it wasn't going to be some quiet, simple plan. You know, his plan was to take over the entire prison. It was the officers' prison, and then take over the prison that was set aside for the soldiers, and then take over Pretoria, and then capture and kidnap the president and end the war. And so he went around, okay, here's the plan, everybody, and they just, you know, go bother somebody else. But then he overheard. So the man he was on, who had invited him to go along, his old friend Ulmer Haldon, and this other guy named Brocky, who is this incredibly scrappy guy. He had been living in South Africa for a while. He spoke Afrikaans. He spoke Zulu. He knew the terrain. He and Haldon had come up with this quiet plan to, you know, when it's dark in that corner, to quickly get over. And Churchill found out, and he said, look, I want to go along with you. And they both said, absolutely not. You know, you're too much trouble. You talk too much. You're going to tell everybody the plan. You're famous. They're going to notice right away. And you're not strong enough. We can't sort of drag you along with us. And but Haldon felt bad about it. He felt like, you know, this is my friend, and it's kind of my fault he's in this position. So he said, look, just so you know, we don't want you to come with us, but I'll leave it up to you. And Churchill said, okay, I'm coming. And so they planned this night, and they all were trying. There's a latrine close to this corner, and so they would go and kind of hide and wait for the guards to turn around or leave, but they just wouldn't. They were right there. They were really watching. So they kept going back and forth, and finally Haldon and Brocky said, you know, let's just go in and have dinner, and then we'll try again after dinner. Churchill said, you know, I'm just going to go take a look. And he got there. The guy turns. He's like, he went over. But then, like I said, he was trapped. There was really nothing he could do. He waited for an hour, crouching in these bushes at great, great risk of being caught. He couldn't go back over. He would be shot. He couldn't go on. He didn't have any of the supplies. He didn't even really know the plan. They hadn't told him much because they didn't trust him. But there he was. And so he thought, I'm going to be captured right away, but what the heck? Let's give it a try.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Going back a little bit to what we were talking about with other correspondents and their take on these things, mm-hmm. Kipling was down there also
right.
as a war
right.
correspondent.
Right.
And in fact, he wrote a famous short story about never coming back the same way you went out in Boer.
Yeah, good advice, right? Right.
So what's your take on him, and did he actually meet up with Churchill at any point?
So Kipling was there. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was also there covering the war. And just another one of these incredible coincidences, Gandhi was also there. He had organized a team of stretcher bearers and was on the same battlefields that Churchill would later be fighting on. And so as far as I know, Churchill didn't meet up with Kipling or Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, but it was great for me, and this is one of my main criteria when I before I commit to any subject, is that there's a lot, just an enormous quantity of primary source material. And so as you might imagine, this story was covered from every conceivable angle by journalists. And as I said, really, Churchill's writing stands far above them all. Yeah.
Yes. Churchill when he went to India as a lieutenant, mm-hmm. lieutenant, his salary was £300 plus, like an American contractor in Iraq. That £300 was about £50,000 now. He goes to, builds up a reputation. He goes to South Africa for the Daily Mirror, is it? Or the Daily
Morning
Mail?
Post.
And for £1,000. How, and that's $150,000 in today's money. How did it work that way? I mean, it's amazing that a neophyte like that, True is very eloquent, a good writer.
Right.
But all, and he gets such a huge pay like that. Were other correspondents getting that sort of money in those days in England?
No, as I said, he was the highest paid correspondent England had ever had. And he had been writing for a while. So he went to Cuba to cover the war there. And as it was a correspondent, was sending things back. He had written in British India. He had written in the Sudan. So he had always been this sort of combination of a soldier correspondent. In fact, because of him, they made a rule that you can't do both anymore because he so openly criticized the men who were in charge. And then when he escapes and he becomes this national hero, and they say, you know, thank you, because they had been losing the war in South Africa, and we're desperate for a hero, and here they have one ready made, and they say, what can we do for you? And he said, you know, I want to go back and fight. I want to be part of a regiment. And they said, well, but you have this commitment to the Morning Post, and as you know, we have this rule that you can't be both. And he says, yes, I know about that, but still I want to do it. And so they let him break this rule that had been established because of him. But yeah, very Churchillian. Thank you.
Besides having, by the way, I loved your prior two books.
Thank
Destiny
you.
Of the Republic and River of Doubt were fabulous.
You. Thank you. It's really nice.
Besides primary source material, talk a little bit about how you select your characters and the focus that you're going to address in your books.
So I began just kind of looking for a great story. So just quickly to tell you this story, and I think I see a few of my National Geographic friends right there. So it was just this incredible. So I had this dream job that I loved so much, and I didn't want to leave. And I got married. My husband has a company in Kansas City, and I thought, you know, maybe we should live together at some point, just being traditional. But I didn't kind of know what to do because I knew that I couldn't do anything in Kansas City that I would love nearly as much. And so he said, he had been a journalist with the New York Times for years, and he said, you should write a book. And I said, yeah, that sounds great. I have no idea how to make that happen. And so I was talking to a friend of mine who had just written a book about the election of 1912. And that Theodore Roosevelt lost when he was trying for his third term in the presidency. And he said, have you ever heard about this trip that Roosevelt took down this unmapped river in the Amazon after? And I was interested in Roosevelt, and I had read some books. But because it's after his active political career, it sort of glossed over. And so I went back, and I started researching, and I was like, oh, my God, you know, there was murder, there was drowning, Roosevelt nearly committed suicide, it's the Amazon, it's this chance to talk about this incredible environment. And so because of that and nothing to do with me, it sold very quickly. And so I realized that I had been given this incredible gift where I could write about something that I was absolutely fascinated by, and where, you know, I'm forced to go to the Amazon and forced to spend years studying and research and working in archives, which I love. And so I was completely hooked. And I wanted, so in the future, I wanted a story that was strong enough that it could carry along with it all these other things that I want to indulge myself in, that I was interested in, like natural history or like, you know, the evolution of medicine in the 19th century or the evolution of modern warfare. But you have to have really a strong enough story, strong enough characters, tangential storylines that support the main story but are fascinating in themselves. And so that's what I look for. But like I said, primarily you have to have a ton of primary source material so you can have dialogue, so you can really have a you hope, deep understanding of the issues. And so you can have all those little details that you hope will help bring a story alive. Thank you.
I was always wondering about Jenny Jerome
and
her contribution to advancing her son's career. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Absolutely. I love to talk about Jenny Jerome. She was a piece of work. She was. So Churchill adored his mother, but as he said, at a distance. So, and in fact, as a mother myself, it was difficult for me to read his early letters to his parents because his father, who was actually very, very harsh to him and very busy with his political career, and here's his mother, this sort of beautiful, glittering society figure who's very busy with her social life, and he's asking them again and again to visit him at boarding school, and they don't. They just don't. And but then his father died, and he becomes an interesting adult, and his mother took an interest in him, and as I said, really helped him. So she had all these relationships, make what you will of that word, with these very powerful men, including like the Prince of Wales. And so he would again and again, you know, look, talk to him and get me an appointment wherever war was happening. So he could, he called it, you know, his glittering gateway to distinction. He thought that was going to make his name. And she did. She helped him again and again. Unfortunately for him, just as he was about to leave for war, she informed him that she was going to marry a man named George Cornwallis West, who was 2 weeks older than he was. And he said, I don't think it'll happen. I don't think you really will do that. But of course, being Jenny, she did. And you'll be shocked to know it didn't work out. So thank you. Yeah.
Hi, Candace. Hi. You talk about relying on primary source material and yet needing to tell a very dynamic, exciting story. This is not historical fiction, but do you allow yourself to take any liberties at all in service of telling a good story?
Absolutely not. No, and it's really, really important to me that people understand that. In fact, I always wince because always along the line, someone will refer to my novel, and it's not a novel. but that's why I think a lot of times with narrative nonfiction, you'll see that in the notes, they're sort of general notes where, you know, by it'll be a couple paragraphs about a chapter saying, in general, you know, these are my sources for that. But it's important to me to say exactly where I found everything. So, how do you know that was a cobblestone street? How do you know that's what he was thinking? Well, that's what he said in his diary. So you'd be able to trace everything back. And that's why it takes me a long time to find my next subject, because I have to, I've had a lot of story ideas that I would love to tell. And it breaks my heart when I figure there's just not enough material to work with. And I won't do it unless I have that.
So even dialogue, for example, how do you construct dialogue?
Because they'll have it, you know, someone will remember it and they'll talk about it in their diary, or they'll report it in a newspaper, or it'll be in a letter. So there's always something there. Or they talk about it in their own account of it. Like Churchill wrote about this. Almer Holden wrote about this, and they recount, and we were talking, and this is what we said. And that's where you can get dialogue.
Though they might disagree. I mean, they might not recount the exact same experience.
Right. And sometimes that happens, and you have to kind of gather as much information as you can and then make a decision what you think is the most reliable. And then sometimes if it is a little difficult to be sure, sometimes I'll put something in a note and say, you know, other accounts say this or that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, only partway through, but it seems like the only thing that matches Churchill's ambition is the ambition of the British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
I was just wondering how that shaped him growing up, like when he was a child, and if he had war heroes or if he had looked at the First Boer War or was inspired by the overextension of the British Empire, mm-hmm. and how that made him want that glory.
It did, very much. As we all know, Churchill was an unabashed imperialist. He was a great believer in the British Empire and believed that it was this sort of benevolent, even helpful, productive force in the world. I mean, he thought everybody would be better off British. And so it absolutely affected him, and especially because, you know, he was born into the highest ranks of the British aristocracy. And as I said, he was fascinated by war. When he was a child, he had a collection of 1,500 little toy soldiers, tin soldiers, that you can still see. There's some at Blenheim Palace and some are in the Imperial War Museum. And it absolutely affected him. I mean, if you think, so this is the height of the British Empire. They ruled over 450 million people, about a quarter of the world's population. It was larger than the Roman Empire at its height, and it was everywhere, and it was stretched incredibly thin because it was always trying to put down revolts. And so Churchill saw this as just an incredible sort of God-given opportunity for him to make his name. Thank you.
Hi, Candace.
Hi.
I just happened by chance to have just read Churchill's own account of this, which is my early years.
Yes, which is a brilliant book. I love it.
And I enjoyed it very much, and uh-huh. I'm certainly going to enjoy your book.
Thank you.
How closely did your research match his recounting or his story?
Uh-huh. Well, it's obviously a great source for me, and if you haven't read it, I would highly recommend it. It's not only absolutely fascinating, but it's hilarious in parts, absolutely yeah. hilarious. It's very much him. It was really interesting. So it was just one of many sources. As I said, Almer Haldon wrote actually two books as well, and he talks about everything that happened from the capture to the imprisonment to the escape, as do many other people, as do the people who helped Churchill at one point. He's helped along the way. And so, yeah, a lot of it actually does size up, and it all kind of fit together, not perfectly at all times, but believably, certainly.
There was one event which I always sort of doubted because it was almost too
incredible.
Much. When he was captured,
mm-hmm.
The man that captured him
right.
was just a common soldier at the time. And a few years later, when Winston Churchill was now a member of, obviously a member of Parliament, but he was also in the government.
Right.
The government of South Africa had sent a representative to negotiate something with the British government.
Mm-hmm.
And he happened to be Mr. Botha.
Mm-hmm.
And when Winston met him, he didn't recognize him, obviously, and Botha came up to him and said, "You don't recognize me,
yeah.
do you?" And Churchill said, "No." He says, "I'm the man who captured you."
Right. It was I, personally,
and
I,
it
right?
It was really Botha?
Well, no. So
I thought not.
Botha organized the capture. Botha was there. It was his plan. He was in charge of it. And Churchill believed...
Okay.
fiercely and defended it. In fact, his son, who started the biography, the famous biography, and hired Sir Martin Gilbert to take it over, and then he died, and Gilbert went on to become the definitive Churchill biographer, went to him and said, "Look, I've checked it out 1,000 different ways, and it can't have been Botha personally who captured you." And he said, "It was. Absolutely, it was. I don't want to hear it, you know, end of discussion." But it wasn't. It was somebody else. But it absolutely was Botha who was in charge and was absolutely aware of Winston Churchill, because Churchill was furious that he had been captured and was missing out on all the glory and excitement of war. So his first approach, aside from planning an escape, was to try to talk the Boers into letting him go. And he's like, "Look, I'm just a correspondent. You know, I didn't have anything to do about it." And they're like, "We read the newspaper accounts, you know." And Botha was like, "I was there. I saw what he did, and he organized the whole thing." And they did become very good friends later in life.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Could you say something about the people who were actually living in this area besides the Boers and the British?
Yeah,
you did on the radio this morning. And elaborate on that.
Thank you. Yeah, I would love the opportunity to. So it was very important to me, to the extent that I could, to also obviously talk about the native Africans whose land this actually was, who had been living there for millions of years. And here come these two white groups insisting, "No, this is my land," and fighting over it. And obviously, you know, both the Boers and the British had set out made an agreement that we won't involve Native Africans. And of course, that quickly fell apart. They used them first as messengers, and then they eventually forced them to fight. And as I talked a little bit about the concentration camps, there were concentration camps just for Native Africans, and more of them died than anybody else in the war. But I was interested to see what they had to say about watching this war take place in South Africa. And I was incredibly lucky to find a man named Solomon Plaikie, who was just one of these rare, extraordinary figures in history. He had taught himself somehow at least 8 different European languages, as well as all the different African dialects he spoke. He served as a translator when Native Africans would be accused of a crime and be hauled into a Boer court and have no idea what was being said. He would help them. He started newspapers, some of the first sort of both English and Native African language newspapers. And he ended up becoming the first secretary of the ANC. And so I was incredibly lucky. I found this diary that a man who, in the 70s, he had gone into Kimberley, which is where Solomon Plaikie lived. And Kimberley, like Ladysmith, was under siege for a long time. And he talked about everything he saw and everything he experienced. And this man had gone into Kimberley in the 70s, and he said, look, does anybody have or know of any written documents that were written by Native Africans about the Boer War? And somebody said, hold on. And they left, and they came back with this sort of torn and dirty and forgotten manuscript, which, trust me, is incredibly beautiful. Incredibly. I could have quoted from Solomon Plaikie all day, and it was very valuable to me. And he absolutely is part of the book. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.